To good evening, the Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. I'm your host for today, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, is my saboteur, Tom Caldwell. How you doing, Tom? When you're not throwing sand in the works?
I've been throwing a lot of sand lately. In January in Canada, there's ice on the sidewalks, and you throw sand. That's how you get through. Don't even get me going on the cold weather. But good to see you guys. Happy to be inside on a warm day.
Yeah.
Inside in the warm house, talking to you.
It has just been absolutely brutal. So the grounds are all slippery, and so my tires don't have very good traction on the road. And I've got studded tires, and I'm slipping all over the place.
You are a studded tire, sir.
I know I am. I got a spare one right here in the front, and I'm a stud. So
you are stupid.
Chris, you probably have no idea what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah. I'll be honest, I would just want you use sand?
Yeah.
I was like, okay, fair. Yeah, we do not use sand. Fair enough.
At different points in the winter, there would be, like, there was recently an ice rain. So the city of Regina will put out a PSA and say, go to your field houses and there's a pile of sand, like a truckload of sand in a pile, and you go take your bucket and you fill it up and then you bring it back and you dump it on your sidewalk. Because otherwise your mailman falls and breaks his hip.
Yeah. No, I understand the thing, but we just have either gritters who come around or it's salt.
Yeah. Well, I use salt or like a synthetic salt also.
Yeah.
By the house, closer to the sidewalk.
Oh, that's cool. It's the sand thing. I'm really entertained. I'm like, oh, Canadians.
Well, you know what else is entertaining? It's minus 30 Celsius today.
Oh, my God. How are you
That's
in a
horrible.
T-shirt?
With no wind chill. It was minus 40 the other day with no wind chill. So it was, and it felt like minus 48 with the wind chill. So it was pretty brutal. But we're talking about warm weather and movies and whatnot, and we've got a lot of fun stuff. But before we get into our discussion on the film today, we have got a hard media report, as we're going to call it, and we're going to talk about a special gift that Tom has received, and we're going to talk about a documentary that Chris has recently watched. So, Tom, why don't you take it away?
So I was very happy to get a text message a couple weeks ago from my good friend Ted Geese from Regina. And he was at Universal Studios in Hollywood on a little vacation with his wife, Michelle. And he said, Tom, do you want a Birds poster or a Psycho poster? And I picked the Birds poster, and he brought me back a beautiful, like, 20-inch framed poster in a heavy plastic cover. And it's proudly displayed on the wall of my Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Podcast home studio in my basement here. So thank you very much, Ted. And if I can mention, Ted and Bill have a wonderful podcast called Bill and Ted Watch Movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it is exactly that name on Facebook. You can follow them. They do a very entertaining show. So when you're done listening to our show once a month, go check out Bill and Ted Watch Movies and enjoy their take on everything to do with film.
Excellent. I couldn't resist.
Excellent, dude.
Excellent, dude. Right on. Well, Chris, now we're going to ask you a couple questions because you recently watched a Hitchcock documentary. You want to tell us which one you watched and tell us a little bit about it?
I did. So for my birthday as a gift, I got the Hitchcock Truffaut documentary, which is about the famous interview that Alfred Hitchcock and Francois Truffaut kind of underwent in 1960-something, in the 60s. And it was a genuinely really interesting documentary. So I'll say for those who might be interested in it, it's not a taping of the interview, and it's not like there are moments when it is kind of, okay, this is what they said, this is what happened, but it's more an exploration of both Hitchcock and Truffaut and their effects on each other, in the sense of, you know, Hitchcock was Truffaut's favourite director, and kind of, you know, it relates to that, and there's some fantastic kind of VTs or talking head stuff with David Fincher's there, Wes Anderson's there, you've got, I think, I've completely forgotten his name, but I think Aronofsky might be in it. But there's just a ton of famous Hollywood directors who have all contributed and said, oh yeah, no, this was really important in developing me as a filmmaker, it was really influential for this and for that. And it's just, if you like Hitchcock, and I know nothing about Truffaut, I'm not a film buff in the sense of I know all about, you know, the new wave or French cinema or that sort of thing, I genuinely found it really interesting. And I came out with a deeper appreciation of both directors because of it. So I would recommend it.
Okay, and so as you said, so it's not really the interviews themselves, it's kind of these movie directors talking about the two filmmakers and talking about the interviews and talking about the influence of these two directors.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you're looking for the actual interview itself, there is the kind of the famous book. I don't know if there's an audio version, because they do have audio clips, so I don't know if the whole thing exists out there somewhere. It might be like an audio book that's available, or a CD or something. But no, it's not a film, because I think it wasn't. They did like some photography, but I don't think they filmed it, which is a shame, really, because I would sit and watch the whole thing of that and be quite happy.
Well, I'm sure the original interviews are all available on YouTube. Like the long film of the interviews are available online.
Ah, see,
and that's the that's the film which became the book.
So yeah,
the book is a transcription of the interviews. Yeah. And that book is, of course, the filmmaker's Bible.
Yeah.
Like, everybody refers to that book. It's a source book we use on our show. That's how important it is.
Yeah.
It gets used on our show.
Yeah.
That's the hallmark of what it's like. You know, it may have influenced directors, but listen, it's one of our go-tos. So, but yeah, if you're interested in kind of the, you know, if you love the interviews and stuff, that's great. If you've never checked them out, I'm going to check them out. I have not listened to them. I will absolutely be checking these out. But if you're interested in either director, I would really recommend you check it out. Or even if you're interested in kind of film and how it's developed, because both of those directors have had such an impact on the way that cinema has developed in, you know, different ways. And they do call back to certain stuff.
If you haven't seen it, I would strongly recommend that you watch at least The 400 Blows by Truffaut. Like, The 400 Blows is an absolute masterpiece.
Okay.
And there's like four sequels to it, I think, that are like the character when he's older.
Right.
But
okay.
The 400 Blows is the best, for sure, out of all of them. And I would definitely recommend that anybody sees that movie. Like, that's a really, really, really great French film. And when my wife and I were in France, we took a vacation there, and it was on our honeymoon, and we kind of went around, and we visited a lot of the sites and the scenery and stuff, and we went to, there's like a very, I can't remember the name of it right now off the top of my head, but there's a very popular graveyard, and a lot of like famous French people are buried in this graveyard, and we got to see like several, because I'm huge into film, we got to go, she stopped by Jim Morrison, because Jim Morrison's buried there, and I got to stop by a few famous French directors, and I got to see Truffaut's grave and Henri-Georges Clouzot. And then there's another graveyard somewhere else where I found Jacques Tati's grave, and it was very hard to find. So if anybody likes Jacques Tati, his grave is actually, it's a stone. I'm getting way off topic here. It's one of those above-ground stone graves, and it's very faded away. It was very sad, and you could almost not make out the name, but it's under his name, his full name of Jacques Tati Chef. So if you do find it and you were looking around for it, it was actually kind of hard to find.
Yeah,
but
I think that's the...
But,
I think it's the... I'm probably butchering this. Père Lachaise Cemetery? I only know because I've seen it in a couple of different films, and I know Oscar Wilde's buried there, apparently.
Yeah, Balzac is there, and, like, you know... I'm sure I said that wrong, but, you know...
Oh, no, I know, but every time, it's like that Simpsons joke, which is like... Balzac, and he's there like, I'm not going to dignify that match, and just turns up. Oh, I'm such a child.
Yeah, I know. We all are. Excellent, right on. Well, we are going to move into our discussion on today's film, and we actually have a special guest to tell us what film we're talking about today, and joining us today is special guest William Shatner to tell us what film we're talking about. Now, William Shatner, what film are we talking about today?
Sabotage.
Well, you kind of say that funny. You said that funny. That's not quite how I pronounce it. What did you say again?
Sabotage.
Oh, okay. Well, I say sabotage.
I don't say sabotage. You say sabotage. I say sabotage.
Well, today's film is Sabotage. Thank you so much, William Shatner.
That's our token Star Trek content for the day.
Yes.
Try and get the film straight. Try and get the film straight there, buddy.
Well, today's film is Sabotage, and it's a good one. I had a lot of fun. This time it was so good that I had to watch it a second time. So I'm actually kind of like this because they're a nice length. I mean, this was only 76 minutes long, you know, so it was a nice length. I was able to watch it again. I watched it 2 days in a row at work on my lunch break and my coffee break. So it worked out pretty well. But we are going to start off with some trivia. And then we are going to get ourselves into a summary by Tom. So we'll start with the trivia. So Sabotage was also released under the name The Woman Alone in 1936. And it's an espionage thriller directed by Hitchcock, starring Sylvia Sidney, Oscar Homolka, and John Loder. It's loosely based on Joseph Conrad's novel, The Secret Agent, about a woman who discovers that her husband, a London cinema owner, is a terrorist agent. Now, this film holds a rare 100% rating for a review aggregator on the website Rotten Tomatoes for critics. Now, I don't know what the difference is, but the audience rating is only 69%, so that's kind of shocking to see that big of a difference on this film. Now, a 2017 poll of 150 actors, directors, writers, and producers and critics for Time Out magazine saw Sabotage ranked as the 44th best British film ever. Wikipedia lists the release date as December 2nd, 1936, and it has a running time of 76 minutes, as I mentioned. Hitchcock wanted to cast Robert Donat again, with whom he previously worked on The 39 Steps, as Spencer, but he was forced to cast John Loder due to Donat's chronic asthma, which we also talked about during the episode 39 Steps. According to Hitchcock, in his interview with French director François Truffaut, Alexander Korda, to whom Donat was under contract, refused to release him. Hitchcock, who was not happy with Loder's casting, later commented that the actor we got wasn't suitable, and I was forced to rewrite the dialogue during the shooting. Hitchcock also chose the young Bobby Rietti, later known as Robert Rietti, to play the part of Steve, but he was not able to sign him for legal reasons. Bennett liberally adapted Joseph Conrad's novel, transforming the highly political Tsarist-era agents, provocateurs, into foreign agents without any obvious political leanings. Verloc's shop is transformed into a cinema, with the films being shown echoing the story when the policeman investigating the case is an undercover officer posing as a greengrocer. Since the film was produced in the years immediately preceding World War II, the unnamed hostile power behind the bombings has been assumed by many viewers to be Nazi Germany. However, the film does not specify this, and indeed Verloc's first name has been changed, presumably because his name in the novel, Adolf, had too many connotations by the time the film was made. Now that's really it for behind the scenes, so we'll talk a little bit about the actors. Sylvia Sidney was born Sophia Cosso on August 8th, 1910, and she was an American actress of stage, screen, and film with a career spanning over 70 years, who first rose to prominence in dozens of leading roles in the 30s. Sidney later came to be known for her role as Juno, a caseworker in the afterlife in Tim Burton's film Beetlejuice. She won a Saturn Award as Best Supporting Actress for this performance. She also was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress for her performance in Summer Wishes, Winter Dreams in 1973. During the Depression, Sidney appeared in a string of films, often playing the girlfriend or sister of a gangster. She's appeared with Gary Cooper, Spencer Tracy, Henry Fonda, Joel McRae, Frederick March, George Raft, and Cary Grant. Among her films from this period were An American Tragedy, City Streets, and Street Scene, all from 1931. Alfred Hitchcock's Sabotage and Fritz Lang's Fury came out in 1936, and You Only Live Once and Dead End came out in 1937. It was during this period that she developed a reputation for being difficult to work with. At the time of making Sabotage with Hitchcock, Sidney was one of the highest paid actresses in the industry, earning $10,000 per week, which earned her a total of $80,000 for Sabotage. This is her only Hitchcock appearance. Now, one interesting thing is, her character in this film was never given a first name, so she's just Mrs. Verloc. I don't know if you guys noticed that or not.
Yeah.
Now, Oskar Homolka was born August 12, 1898, and he was an Austrian film and theater actor who went on to work in Germany, Britain, and America. Both his voice and his appearance fitted him for roles as communist spies or Soviet officials, for which he was in regular demand. By the age of 30, he had appeared in more than 400 plays. His film career covered at least 100 films and TV shows. After serving in the Austro-Hungarian Army during the First World War, Homolka attended the Imperial Academy of Music and the Performing Arts in Vienna, the city of his birth, and began his career on the Austrian stage. In 1924, he played Mortimer in the premiere of Brecht's play, The Life of Edward II of England, at the Munich Kammerspiel, and in 1925 in Berlin, where he worked under Max Reinhardt. This is his only Hitchcock film appearance, but he was in three episodes of Alfred Hitchcock's Presents: Reward to Finder, The Icon of Elijah, and The Hero. Desmond Tester was born the 17th of February, 1919, and he was an English film and television actor. He was born in London, England, and started his career as a child actor. Among his most notable roles was the ill-fated boy Stevie in the film Sabotage. Tester made his first stage appearance at the age of 12 in The Merry Wives of Windsor, receiving positive reviews from London. He was known more as a child actor in film in his native Britain. Tester's characters often met with doomed fates in such early films as Carol Reed's The Midshipman Easy, Tudor Rose, Robert Stevenson's Nonstop New York, The Stars Look Down, and in Sabotage. He also appeared in The Drum, and after the Second World War, he moved to Australia and embarked in careers in radio, theater, and television. As television broadcasting began in Australia, Tester soon found work with Channel 9's What's My Line and in a variety of children's programs including Cabbage Quiz and Caper Cops with Reg Gorman and Rod Hull. He spent 15 years at Channel 9 taking charge of children's programming and became more involved behind the scenes in production and publicity. He later moved to the Reg Gundry Productions, eventually leaving the industry entirely due to a dislike of the overall management culture. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. And lastly, John Loder was born William John Muir Lowe on the 3rd of January, 1898, and he was a British actor who later became an American citizen in 1947. Loder followed his father into the army, being commissioned into the 15th Hussars as a second lieutenant on the 17th of March, 1915, and then served in the Gallipoli campaign, leaving there on the 19th of December that year. On the 21st of April, 1916, until early May, Loder was in Ireland before proceeding to Rouen, France, to rejoin his regiment. He was engaged in the 1916 Battle of the Somme and was taken prisoner by the Germans on the 21st of March, 1918, at the village of Roiselle. He was later taken to Le Cateau jail and then by train to the first of several prisoner of war camps at Rastatt in Baden, Germany. Upon being released, he stayed in Germany, resuming military duties on behalf of the Inter-Allied Commission in Breslau and Upper Silesia. Oh my goodness, these are hard names to say. Leaving the cavalry, Loder went into business with a German friend, Walter Becker, establishing a pickle factory in Potsdam. Later, Loder began to develop an interest in acting. He appeared at the British Theatre Guild in Berlin and enjoyed a triumph in productions of The Last of Mrs. Cheney and another play called Loyalties. He began appearing in bit parts in a few German films at the Tempelhof Film Studios, including Dancing Mad. He had a good part in Madame Wants No Children, directed by Alexander Korda, and he appeared in The Last Waltz, The White Spider, The Great Unknown, Fair Game, When the Mother and the Daughter, Casanova's Legacy, The Sinner, and Adam and Eve. While this is his only Hitchcock appearance, he did have an extensive film career. And finally, there is no Hitchcock cameo in this film.
Interesting.
Tom, did you want to give us a summary?
I will. I can't stand it. I know you planned it. I'm going to set it straight, this Watergate. I can't stand rocking when I'm in here, because your crystal ball ain't so crystal clear. So while you sit back and wonder why,
Well, no, wrong sabotage. Wrong sabotage.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's the Beastie Boys sabotage. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. I must have typed that in wrong.
Oh, that's okay. That's sorry, an easy guys, mistake to make. Easy mistake to make. We understand.
Listen, y'all, I guess that's a sabotage.
Did you purposely sabotage this podcast?
Perhaps. But you know, I'm out and I'm gone. I'll tell you now. I'll keep it on and on. So, Chris, help me out here, buddy. Can you get us back on track?
Oh, my God. Okay. So,
if we just had to do it, listeners. I'm so sorry. I know these jokes are painful, but
we
just had to.
It's a mirage.
How dare you? These jokes are amazing. So, sabotage. 1936. A ring of saboteurs is causing havoc in London with a series of explosive terrorist attacks. Carl Verloc, played by Oscar Homolka, is part of the group, but he maintains a cover as a kind movie theatre owner. His wife, Sylvia Sidney, is beginning to suspect something, though, and so is Scotland Yard Detective Sergeant Ted Spencer, played by John Loder. What neither of them know, however, is that Verloc uses his wife's little brother, Desmond Tester, to deliver the bombs in film canisters.
That is evil.
Yeah, I know.
Excellent. Okay, so I want to talk about the one... Okay, so there's two things in this movie that bother me, yeah. But I love this movie. I think it's great. Okay. So watching it twice, I wanted to ask you guys about the relationship that she had with her husband. It felt weird to me, and I wanted to address this right away because I do want to focus on the good stuff in the film, but I didn't quite understand the relationship that she had with this guy, and I didn't quite understand that he was the husband. Did you guys get that right away? Did it seem like it was like an arranged marriage, or I don't know, like it just felt kind of weird to me because she says at one point that she used to live in the States and they moved back to Britain because of the economy wasn't doing very well in the States. And then did she meet him here? I don't know, like what are your impressions of it? It just seemed a little bit odd, that's all.
Yeah. I kind of thought it was a bit of, particularly with what happens later in the film with regards to her character, I thought it was a case of, oh, look, here's two people who married for, like, advantageous reasons. I thought it was like, oh, okay, he's thought, I need a wife, hasn't really cared who, and she's thought, well, it's the appropriate thing, I need a husband no matter what. Or she was pressured into it by a family, or it was kind of a societal, you know, thing at the time, because they don't have any kids of their own, but she's got a younger brother who's a dependent, basically, so... I don't know, I just thought, yeah, their relationship was weird, and then particularly how her relationship with Spencer develops was a bit of a weird, because I was like, oh, okay, that's something. But no, I just thought it was a bit of a case of not an arranged marriage, but it made me think of like kind of a Jane Austen style. He asked and he was rich, so, you know, and I might not have a lot of other prospects.
Mm-hmm. Tom, what did you think of the relationship?
When the film opens and he causes the power outage and the cinema goes dark and all the patrons of the cinema are leaving and she goes up. Now he's got a house attached to the cinema, like they live in the back of the cinema and they have offices in the back of the cinema. And she goes up to the bedroom and he's pretending that he was napping the whole time and didn't know what was going on. But, and she comes in and says, well, you know, there's a power outage and all the patrons want their money back. And what should we do, boss? And I got the whole impression initially that she just worked for the cinema and he was the owner of the cinema. Like, I didn't get a married vibe off of them at all.
Yeah.
And she seems a lot younger than him. And then when she is flirting and going for lunch with Ted, the green grocer, that, again, had me right away under the impression that she was just a single young lady that worked at the cinema. And I didn't get the, you know, Mrs. Verloc, the married to the owner vibe at all off the beginning.
Yeah, and like I said, I watched this 2 days in a row And I'm like, I still could not get the impression that these were like husband and wife. It was just weird. Now, I'm not hung up on it. Like, it doesn't take away from my enjoyment of the film. I just wanted to see what other people felt. Now, the only other problem that I want to talk about with this film, and I want to ask you guys what your impressions of, were the two times that Verloc was like denying that he knew any knowledge of anything. Like, for the example, the scene where you just said where he was pretending to nap. I loved the actor. I thought he did a really great job, except when he was denying stuff. I'm like, so when he wakes up and he's like, oh, why are you shining that torch on me? Why don't you just turn on the light? Because we have electricity, don't we? Electricity runs light bulbs, and you could just flip that little switch over there and turn the light on, and we could just have the light on in the room. Don't you think we could do that instead of having this flashlight? And so that was weird. And then when the Scotland Yard police detective gets the phone call about the blowing up of the bus, and he's just initially like, the bus blew up? Well, look what time it is. I'm here. I mean, I couldn't have blown it up, right? Because I'm like in front of you, and you're my alibi, right, officer? You're going to be my alibi when they come and ask me about this, right, sir? You know, like, it's just, I don't know, like, it's just the way that he acted those two lines and the way those two scenes were written were like just ridiculously over the top for a spy.
I thought that Homolka was very well cast in the role, that he looked the part. He looked like a dirty jerk, right? Like, he looked like a really bad guy. But yeah, like, your point is more that his acting wasn't exactly...
It just in those two scenes, right?
Yeah.
The rest of it, I thought he was brilliant. Honestly, I thought he was really good in the rest of it. It was just those two scenes.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's a good point. But no, he definitely, like you said in your summary of the actors, you know, you can understand why he played so many villains, and he has that real ugly, nefarious look to him, which served him well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's just get on to talking about the film. And the one thing that really, really fascinates me about this movie, and honestly... You know, as much as I like how cinema has changed and how things are kind of paced, I really love this movie because of how tight it is.
Yeah.
The storytelling in this movie is so tight. It's 76 minutes and so much happens in it, but not a lot happens in it.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, the story is so well constructed that there's nothing missing. I don't think they need to have expanded anything. I fully understand everything that's going on. And I really love how tight this movie is in just a mere 76 minutes long. Like, in this day and age that we have films, like, people don't even take a movie seriously, it seems, unless it's, like, at least 2 hours long. It's like there's
well,
this...
And this film, it opens really quickly and it hits the ground running. Like, it so much happens immediately. But it was a very interesting opening with all this intense dialogue about the moviegoers are in the theater and the power goes out and they try to get their money back. And there's all this very intelligent discussion going on. Ted, the green grocer at the time, we only know him as the green grocer at the time, comes over to help the ladies that are running the theater, talks the patrons into not getting their money back. Meanwhile, Mrs. Verloc has got permission from Verloc to give the money back. So there's a lot of back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, okay, we'll give you your money back. And the power comes on. Like, that was pretty entertaining.
Yeah.
Ted, as the green grocer, tells everyone, it's an act of God. You know, like, this is, you can't control what happens when the power goes out in the theater. They all made it very dramatic. I really enjoyed that. But like you said, it's a fast-moving film. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on.
Mm-hmm. Chris, what do you think about the plot and the story writing of the film?
I think I enjoyed it less than you guys, but I think for a different reason. But it is very efficient. It's very tight. Ironically, it makes me think of some films from like 10, 15 years ago that owe a lot to Hitchcock. So it's just that kind of full circle thing. But yeah, it sets everything up very quickly. You get to know the main kind of quartet of characters very quickly. You get to meet Ted, you get to meet the Verlocs, you get to meet, you know, Steve relatively quickly. And it within the first kind of 5-10 minutes, you kind of know everyone's... Because by and large, apart from Ted's revelation, you kind of know their alignment, really, in the sense of, you know, something's a bit wrong with Verloc. You know, why is he putting sand to mess with the electricity? You know, Mrs. Verloc, you know, is our, I guess, protagonist, for lack of a better term. You've got kind of Ted, who's got this weird, kind of weird flirty relationship with Mrs. Verloc. You've got all this kind of thing. But no, it is, it's very tight. I agree with what you're saying in that a lot happens and then also doesn't happen. You know, the actual plot is very simple. It's about them creating a terrorist, you know, attacks and all that sort of thing. Which, I'll be honest, having watched it a few days ago, I don't actually remember what the point of the attacks were.
Well, they don't say. So the first one is just to shut the electricity off, and then it doesn't generate enough fear. The people laugh, so they're like, well, fine, then we'll just blow a bomb up inside of Piccadilly Square, I think is where they were going to put it.
The evil organization is anonymous, and... Like, we, historically looking back, everyone infers that it's Nazi Germany.
Yeah, exactly, because of the accents and
covertly,
the timing.
Covertly trying to disrupt life in London, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's secondary to the story. Like, that's not part of the story. It's just that we know that these bad guys are doing their sabotage to you know, the good people of London.
Yeah. So it's effectively almost like a non-physical MacGuffin. We don't really care why it's happening. It's more, here are our characters, here's some good, here's some bad, let's move them towards the end and we're going to put stuff in the way and we're going to do all this, that sort of thing. But no, I still enjoyed it, but, and I think the main thing that got to me, and it's something that Hitchcock himself, I believe, came to regret, is and it is the middle sequence of the film, and it is kind of the most tense sequence, is when you've got Steve with the package on the bus. And for me personally, I was annoyed. I mean, because it is, you know, he did mention in an interview years after this, saying that he regrets it because there was no release of tension. There was no kind of, it went off, yes, but the audience didn't get to do a sigh of relief. They just felt shocked, and it wasn't resolved in a way. Which you know, I get. I think that's what annoyed me, because it just, I don't like seeing kind of innocent people die anyway, particularly in cinema. So that whole thing, it got me a bit. I'll be honest, the fact he died petting a cute dog, it got me. He's there petting the puppy, and I'm like, no.
That,
you know,
that really is a first for Hitchcock films to this point. Like, he actually killed a young boy who's a major character, and he dies tragically. He killed a child, right? And it's a really brave move that hit those audiences very hard, and it hit us hard, I think, watching it.
I mean, it's... it is kind of the go-to, though, weirdly, in more modern cinema. And, oh, I feel bad. I'm going to... I'm sort of going to spoil one small thing about a recent horror film, if that's okay. And you can just skip ahead about 30 seconds. It's about the 2018 Halloween.
You're going to say which horror film it is.
2018 which Halloween. One?
Okay, yeah, so... I know where you're going to go there, and we got a 2018 Halloween spoiler, so skip ahead like 30 seconds.
Yeah. So basically, during the kind of opening onslaught when Michael escapes, you think, oh, there's a young kid there, his dad's died, the kid's going to escape, that sort of thing, except he doesn't. He gets his neck broken in quite, not graphic, but kind of, it's very visual, and you see it happen up close.
Yeah, I can't believe they went there in that movie.
Yeah. You know, I thought, and then there's a bit, as when he's walking through the house, and he stops by the crib, and I just thought, that's now, too fat. And he doesn't, he just walks away and everything. But it's that kind of, it has become like a kind of an easy way to kind of get a horrified, invested reaction out of an audience. It's a bit like, you know, when they kill an animal, or it's just, it's somewhat innocent and defenseless and all that sort of thing. But I think in this, it did annoy me, because I saw Steve and I'm like, he's fine, he's a young kid, you know. And you do get some, you do get justice in the end, you know, and that's something to be discussed, but it's just, that I think that was the other thing that left kind of a sour taste in my mouth. And I think I thought, looking into it, because, and we will mention this, but the you know, the use of cartoons throughout the film and kind of film reels, and they help kind of supplement the plot a bit. Well, the last one is Who Killed Cock Robin? Mm-hmm. And I thought, having seen Who Killed Cop Robin before I watched the film, I thought, oh, is it going to be, like, the twist at the end is that she's going to have killed her husband, and it turns out the lad survived somehow. Because I thought, oh, is it going to be like a parallel where it's like, he's been dead, and there's an investigation, and that sort of thing, and then it turns out he survived. I thought, oh, is that going to be the twist? Where it makes audiences feel better, and then she's faced with the fact that she has killed a terrorist, but not for the right reason, if that makes any sense. I thought that was going to be it, and I was a bit disappointed when that didn't happen. But no,
no,
I...
he's still dead.
Yeah, still dead.
He's still dead.
Well, and for Burlock,
yeah,
the situation he's in, like his wife's brother, so, you know, pretty much his brother.
His brother-in-law.
Like... Verloc knew the risk to the boy, Steve, when he assigned the boy to do the errand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then when Verloc did not deliberately kill Steve, he's responsible for the death. But that's the ends to which Verloc is willing to go to achieve the goal of the terrorism, yeah, or the sabotage, right?
Yeah.
That's one thing. I will say he's one of the worst, and I mean it in a positive way, I guess. Like, he's horrible and you really hate him. One of the worst Hitchcock villains, because when Mrs. Verloc finds out, he basically then goes, oh, well, it was the Scotland Yard's fault and that sort of thing. It's like, no, you literally gave him the bomb, you prick. I'd much rather have a bad guy who admits, you know what, it was me, I used it for this reason, blah blah blah, and he just goes around denying it and blaming other people, and I'm like, oh, if she didn't stab you then, I'd have stabbed you.
Yeah.
Could I talk about some of the Hitchcock references that I enjoyed seeing?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
And this is what really brought it home for me when I was watching the film. This is how I got into this film, and immediately I felt comfortable. Like, I felt like it was all very familiar to me. So, starting off, Ted is a greengrocer. So this is the house that Alfred was born into. The house of his dad was a greengrocer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the greengrocer is next to a movie theater. So again, movie theaters are very familiar. And I love Simpson's restaurant, the posh steakhouse. This to me seems like one of the places that Alfred Hitchcock would eat lunch. And when Ted was reading the menu to Steve and Mrs. Verloc, oysters, caviar, smoked salmon, fried, grilled, or broiled sole, roast saddle of mutton, you know, roast sirloin, chopped steak. To me, that's just Alfred ordering lunch right there. Like,
he ordered all of it?
That's the kind of, bring me the menu. Like, those are true stories. That would be the type of lunch the guy would have. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm not exaggerating.
You can imagine him turning to Al Munch being like, and you're having...
Yeah. And soup for the lady. Now, it was interesting, like, there's a knife that happens later on, there's a stabbing, and the violence happens off screen, like when the bus blows up, we don't really see the true explosion of the bus, it happens off camera, and Brandon, you mentioned there was no Hitchcock cameo, but I would credit the professor as being almost a Hitchcock lookalike. The bomb maker in the bird shop.
Yeah.
Mm. And, of course, all the bird references. Brandon, I think you wanted to talk a bit about birds.
Yeah.
So much of this happens in the bird shop, which is really the front for the explosives depot and the poison depot of the saboteurs. But the birds are very prevalent, and that is a very interesting foreshadow to something that might come later in Hitchcock's career, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did want to talk a little bit about the Birds themes that's going on here. Now, I know it's fun to make the joke that he did the movie called The Birds later on. I don't think that this foreshadowed that myself, though. But, you know, there is a lot of references to birds in this film. Like, the birds will sing on Saturday at 1:45. You know, when they have the code word for that, you've got the bird shop, you've got the two birds in the cage. And then we've got the film Who Killed Cock Robin, you know, in here as well. So there's like, I don't quite know what that means, but I do notice that the birds are really prevalent in this film. Do you guys think that that might have some kind of meaning in this movie?
Well, I mean, based off what you and Tom have said, and I was just going through like birds or that sort of thing, but it does sort of appear in a lot of his films. I mean, the one I think of is Psycho, because Norman Bates, he has a wall full of taxidermied birds.
Yeah.
Or no, he mentions birds, he's like...
Marion Crane.
Yeah. He's like, oh, the birds, they're kind of half dead already, and kind of... There might be this metaphor for kind of death. Because in the birds, it's literally the birds as messengers of death. You know, the birds will sing at 1:45, it's like a code, you know. That's all that thing.
Yeah, that's not the most suspicious thing I've ever heard. Like, if someone were to come across that note, the birds will sing at 1:45 on Saturday, you're like,
there's
bad
no
stuff's
nuance.
Going down on 1:45 on Saturday. There's no subtlety about that. You don't know what it means, but there's no subtlety that something bad's not going to happen, you know.
It's like going, the cock will crow with what? Are you just like, oh, what's going to happen?
Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes.
Exactly.
One more Hitchcock sort of historical reference here. When the bombs are attached to or inside canisters of film. And we know from an early episode of our series of podcasts that we talked a lot about the problems with film burning and the explosivity of the nitrate film. And I thought that was a cute reference or an interesting way that at the time they would have used these film reels as explosives or part of the bombs. But there's also a huge foreshadowing by the bus conductor when Steve gets on the bus, where the conductor says, well, those canisters of film are awfully dangerous. I shouldn't let you on. So he pretty much got Bus Conductor of the Day award right there.
Yeah, see, the interesting thing about that, I thought they were going to go on a misdirect and blame the explosion on the film. Like
an innocent bomb.
Yeah, like I thought that that's what was going to end up happening, is that it was going to be some kind of a fake misdirect that would take us on, like the cops on some kind of wrong tangent. So I was actually kind of surprised when they didn't do that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And well, that, you know, that reference to the dangerous canisters of film by the conductor really helps to remind the viewer that there's a risk in these films.
Mm-hmm.
So at the time, the viewer of that day probably knew that from watching the news, but the viewer from this era, from our life, you know, today, wouldn't necessarily have known the history of the burning film.
Yeah,
so that's a nice touch that the modern viewer gets that historical information reminded to them quickly.
Yeah, because nowadays you'd be like, what's so explosive about a USB?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a great, great quote, which is, I'm sure Hitchcock didn't mean it, but it's very subtle. And it's very self-deprecating, where Ted is asking Stevie to take him to Homolka's office, or Verloc's office, backstage. And Ted asks to go into the projector, the space behind the screen, and says, is there anything interesting back here? And Stevie says, it's only the screen. There's not much to look at. I'm like, really? That's everything we look at. That is the film. I thought that was a great little subtle jab in there.
It's a nice little meta thing. One thing I did notice, and this is only because I grew up in a religious household, the film that the bomb on the bus is concealed in is called Bartholomew the Strangler, which is obviously a fake film. And I thought, oh, is it a reference to like The Lodger? Is it like a little in-joke there, that sort of thing? But St. Bartholomew was one of the apostles, and I thought this was... if it's intentional, it's a great way to foreshadow Verloc's death, because Bartholomew was skinned, but with a knife, which is the same thing.
That's why we pay Chris the big money, right there.
He gets 75% of our profits.
That's
all
that's
them religious
the kind of in-depth
deaths.
Reporting. We dig deeper on this show, ladies and gentlemen.
I noticed it when it was like Bartholomew, because he peels the canister off. And I was like, oh, okay, mm-hmm. That's cool. That's a reference. It might have just picked at the name, but if that's intentional, that's a nice little kind of nod. Mm-hmm.
See, I really loved that this movie took place in a cinema. I really like movies that are like about movies that are about filmmaking, things like that. So to have a movie take place in a cinema, I think is really fascinating.
Yeah.
And I really kind of love it. Now, again, because I didn't quite catch it on my first watch, I didn't understand when that door opened and it's like, oh, it sounds like somebody just got murdered. And they were like, it took me two viewings to catch what that meant. And it was like, well, that was the window that popped open that he fell through later on, which was behind the screen. So the murder that he heard was a movie being projected at that exact moment, right?
Yeah,
so,
right.
But I don't know. I really like the idea of this taking place in a film cinema, because it's just this general job that she has. I'm a film studio, or I'm a film projector manager. I'm a film movie theater manager. That's what her job is, you know? And to have this whole thing of espionage going around something so mundane as movie projection, it's just kind of fascinating to me, you know? Like, I really loved this movie, and I thought it was really cool.
Well, espionage is a world of illusion and fakery and deceit, right?
Yeah.
Hollywood, like, films are the same thing. So they're a nice pairing.
Yeah, I never thought about that. That's pretty cool.
They lend themselves well to each other. Mm-hmm. I thought the clandestine meeting with Verloc at the zoo.
Oh, the aquarium, yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful Cold War sort of espionage, secret code whispering in the dark, and I really enjoyed that. And I'd like to research this, but they use the line, follow that taxi. The inspector jumps in the back of the police van, follow that taxi, which... Mm. I'm sure has been used 100 times since in various movies. That's a wonderful espionage cliche that I enjoyed hearing. Mm-hmm. Follow that cab.
Yep. Now, Hitchcock himself references this movie quite a bit. Now, you had mentioned that there was something that he didn't like, which was not relieving the pressure. But he does refer to this film quite a bit as well, where he's like, look, this is how you create surprise versus suspense. Mm. Right? Where surprise is... You know, there's this kid on the bus, and he's walking around town, and he's sitting there with the dog, and all of a sudden, boom.
Yeah.
You know, it creates a second of surprise, because you don't know what's going on, where this creates, you know, minutes upon minutes of suspense, because you know that this bomb is going to blow up at a specific time.
Yeah.
And here's the guy, you know, he stops, he's going for a walk, he can't cross the street because there's a parade, then he stops and he gets his teeth brushed, and, you know, like all these things are preventing him from getting where he needs to go.
Yeah.
So that's suspense. And so Hitchcock himself refers to this. Now, I really love that scene. Like, you know, I don't think I've seen this movie before, but I knew about that sequence.
Yeah.
And even knowing about that sequence... Both times that I watched it, I'm like, this is suspenseful. Like, this is crazy suspenseful. Even knowing what was happening, you know, like, which that's just master cinema construction.
And technically speaking, at the time, you could find out the time of day in a limited number of places. So that clock on the storefront and the public street was the clock that you would refer to.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
He kept seeing those clocks and it's like, oh my God, it's 1:30, it's 1:35, get out of there, get going. The tension was wonderful.
Yeah.
I love this film, how tight it was. So, Chris, is there anything else that you want to talk about? Is there any, because you had said you didn't really like it as much as it sounded like Tom and I do. So what else detracted for you other than the death of the innocent?
To be honest, I mean, that was the main thing, because I went through it and it was interesting because I think it has a lot of underlying themes that are quite interesting. You know, there's a lot of kind of sex and gender and stuff in there in terms of, well, there's two. First of which is that even though I would say Verloc is our main character, he's also the villain. And you've got Mrs. Verloc then, who is the kind of protagonist or the hero or whatever. But she never gets given a name, like a first name.
Yeah.
She's never allowed to be called, oh, Jean or, you know, whatever the hell the name is. It's like, no, Mrs. Verloc. Or she's just, you know, so she's tied inherently to him. But then there was that joke which I thought was funny, at the aquarium, which is, it's a, I think it's like a couple on a date or something, and they're like, oh, did you know that oysters change sex after they lay 1,000 eggs? And she's like, well, wouldn't you?
I don't blame them or something like that.
There's that little, you know, joke and everything. I think it was more that it was more like, you know, because I think I've seen the same interview you have where he describes, like, you know, there's a bomb under the table. It's going to go off in 5 minutes, and the two people are sat there talking, and you're there screaming at the screen, "Con, you've got to get out! You've got to get out!" But it's, you know, he himself said he didn't kind of release the tension, and it was just like a nasty thing for the audience. Now, by today's standards, it's fine. It's not that big of an issue, but I think it was just because of the way it was skillfully done. It's a great sequence. I just kind of wish it just been done a bit differently, that sort of thing. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just, you know, my personal taste. I'm literally made like notes. I'm going through stuff that I thought was really cool. So when Mrs. Verloc faints, when she finally twigs that, you know, Steve has died on the bus and everything, she passes out, and then in the kind of the crowd that forms, I thought it was really cool how for a few seconds he just pops in. Just Steve, he appears in the crowd. And I remember thinking that was really cool, because rather than having
a mirage.
Yeah.
It's a mirage, it's a fantasy.
But rather than having like the cheesy fading where it's like, ooh, that sort of thing, it's like, no, he just pops in. And then she looks another part, and he just pops in, that sort of thing. Which I just thought that was quite a cool technique. It was only for like 2 or 3 frames. But no, I thought that was cool. I thought that the ending, well, the last third of it, was interesting. And it's the idea of natural justice prevailing over like moral or legal justice, in the sense of, she got revenge for the death of her brother by stabbing him. And you would think, you know, she's ready to confess, and she does say he's dead just as the bomb goes off, and you think, oh god, what's gonna, you know, that sort of thing. And it's basically, she gets away with it. She's willing to turn herself in, but she manages to get away with it. And the idea of, it's like, okay, well, balance has been restored now. You know, the innocent life that was taken, or the innocent lives that were taken, the person who's behind it is now dead. So rather than her going to prison for killing her husband, it's like, she's cleared a debt, basically. She's balanced it out. But no, I mean, having discussed it, as always happens when I'm talking to you guys, having discussed it, I'm like, okay, I actually do enjoy it more. I still have the issues with the bus thing, but that is just, like I said, that's just me. That is me being a soft sod who don't like the idea of, like, some poor kids.
But that's
kids
okay. It's okay to not be happy with the fact that this boy died. But does that take away from your rating of the film, though? Like, you know,
not
like, for example,
really,
like,
no.
Have you ever seen Antichrist?
No, I am not. I know what happens in Antichrist, but I haven't seen it.
I can never, ever watch Antichrist ever again by Lars von Trier. Like, but it is an absolute masterpiece, 5 out of 5 film that I will never, ever be able to bring myself to watch again.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where it's like, if you know something, and it's because we're discussing this with books, and it's the same thing with films. If you know a film is well regarded and everything, and everyone's telling you, oh, you need to watch this, you need to read this, you need to listen to this, if you know it's got something in it that you're not going to like, you know, you are more than welcome to challenge yourself and to kind of expose yourself to new stuff and all that sort of thing. But equally, you don't have to. No one's making you, you know.
Yeah,
there are certain films where I was like, okay, cool, so basically it's like torture porn. I'm like, but everyone loves it. I'm like, yeah, I'm not going to see it, because I don't like that kind of stuff, so why would I watch and spend my time watching something that doesn't make me happy? This is a very well done film that I'll maybe watch again, you know, having looked back on it, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is cool, that's, you know, that part's enjoyable. I thought the ending sequence where he puts on, and it's basically the suicide bomber jacket at the end, you know, when he kind of detonates, it was just, it, yeah, it's better than I initially thought on reflection. I do still have my issues with it, but it's still one of the better Hitchcocks that we've seen so far.
Did you have a rating for it?
I would say 4 smoking film canisters out of 5.
Damn it! You stole my reference. I was going to do 4.5, and I was going to do film. No, okay. So 4.5 ripped up tickets to the cinema that you're not getting your money back. You paid for this. You did not pay for the seat that you put your feet on, buddy. Get out of the cinema. That's my rating.
That's your rating. Did you have anything else that we missed that you wanted to address, or did we cover everything?
There is no terror in the bang, only the anticipation of it.
Oh,
yeah, see, that's the quote, yeah.
So that's a perfect example, that whole, the boy delivering the package, getting the anticipation of the bang of that bomb that we know is going to go off. That's what terror is about to Hitchcock.
Yeah.
That's the experience that you paid for.
Yeah, I love it. Well, there's nothing much on the film that I want to add. I loved it. I think this might be my new favorite Hitchcock film. Like, I really, really loved this one, and so I definitely gave it 5. And so my rating is 5 bowls of green cabbage, because you know I'm very particular about that kind of thing. So,
is it the long cabbage or is it the skinny cabbage? That was
either one. As long as it's green,
they spent way too much time. Spent way too much time talking about cabbage in this film.
Yes. Now, before we go, did we want to talk a little bit about the film? I think we all got a chance to watch it, the Who Killed Cock Robin short, the Silly Symphony from Disney. I've got a quick summary of it. I just think it's interesting to talk about this because it's interesting that this is actually like a real film.
Yeah,
that's in here. Now, our friend Pat McFadden helped to guide us to this, and I asked him, because there is another movie in here that you see a few clips from, but he hasn't been able to find anything on that, and I couldn't either. But I went to Wikipedia, and I've got a quick summary I'll read you of the short film itself. And again, it's just one of those silly symphonies, which were like 7 or 8 minute little films that Disney would produce in the 30s and release in cinemas. So here's the summary from Wikipedia. While Cock Robin, can we say cock on the podcast? Cock Robin? Caricatured after Bing Crosby, serenades over the Mae West-esque Jenny Wren, an unseen assailant shoots an arrow into Cock Robin's heart and he falls to the ground, giving the other birds in the tree the impression he's been shot and killed. The police arrive at the scene and arrest Harpo Marx like cuckoo, an Edward G. Robinson-inspired sparrow, possibly an homage to the original story, and Stepan Fetchit-based Blackbird as suspects. The next day, a trial is held over the identity of Cock Robin's assassins, while an owl serving as the judge and a parrot as the prosecutor interrogating the suspects and showing Cock Robin's body as evidence. The Blackbird confesses he hadn't done, seen, or known anything about it. The sparrow refuses to say anything. Cuckoo doesn't know either, but continually points to the judge and the parrot, and even himself, showing that he is indeed Cuckoo. Everyone is astounded that no one knows who murdered Cock Robin. At that moment, Jenny Wren arrives and demands that she sees justice done for her Cock Robin. Eventually, the judge declares that all 3 of the suspects be hanged, as they don't know which one of them is guilty. Just then, an arrow strikes the judge's hat, and its owner, Cock Robin's supposed killer, is revealed to be Cupid. He reveals that Robin isn't dead at all. He simply fell for Jenny Wren and is currently unconscious. The arrow he was shot with is in his armpit. Jenny revives Robin, and they kiss to the excitement of the jury. And so, as this was done in the 30s, it's not the most politically correct film, and we'll address that right off the bat. There's some pretty extreme racist stereotypes in here, as well as a homophobic representation of Cupid, which are well over the top. But yeah, so we've got the Blackbird, who's like talking in a very thick, you know, black slave type accent. We've got the Irish cop, and then we've got Cupid, which honestly I found fascinating that they portrayed Cupid as this over-the-top homosexual, where I've never seen Cupid portrayed by anything other than a little baby before.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. And I don't know that there's much to say. It's just interesting that they actually used a piece of cinema in this film. Like, this is something that exists. And, you know, like, with copyright and whatnot, the fact that they have something by Disney as well, I think is really fascinating. So,
They promote the fact that there's a Disney clip in the film Sabotage in the opening credits with a special appearance by Disney.
Oh, did they? You know, I didn't notice that. Piece.
Yeah. But this Who Killed Cock Robin has got police brutality. It's got rampant the racism of, well, we can't figure out the murderer, so let's just kill all the suspects. It's got that, yeah, that horrible connotation. I swore this thing was produced by Andrew Dice Clay. Like, it was as offensive as possible on so many fronts. But in the day, did the viewers find it offensive, or did they just have no idea that they were being offended? I don't know.
Yeah, like, I have no doubt that in the 36 or whenever it was, 32 or whatever it was that this was made, that this was just like, this is just how we portray these things on screen.
Yeah.
But, you know, you look back and it's not so tasteful anymore. So, but, Chris, did you have anything wanted to add on the short film?
No, I mean, I did. when you asked before we started recording, you were like, oh, did you watch the thing? And I went, oh, you mean the one with the very hypersexualized Mae West Bird and the gay Cupid? And you were like, yeah, that one. Yeah, it is very much a product of its time. The race stuff is very icky, and it, you know, isn't fantastic at all. The gay Cupid thing, I think it has more to do with the fact that, kind of, you know, Cupid is the, or Eros, or whatever, is, you know, the Greek-Roman god of romance and that sort of thing. So it might have been they just couldn't justify a male. I don't know why I just didn't go with the baby, to be honest. But yeah, they just thought, we're going to go kind of camp.
I've never seen Cupid as anything but a baby.
You know, I mean, in the traditional Greek myth, he is like a fully grown man and has his own adventures and kind of big romantic story with Psyche and everything. But then it's like, well, why just make him a baby? Everyone knows Cupid as like a cute baby. Why Phil, you know what, we've been super racist, now let's put like a little homophobia chaser in there just to sell the whole
thing.
They were
aiming at the lowest common denominator in this production.
Which, maybe they thought, oh, you know, we'll pop it in, that sort of thing. I don't think Hitchcock's really got anything. Well, at the moment, maybe later on, he's got anything really to say that kind of like. Well, it's weird talking about race because we've just relatively recently done the film before this one, whose name I don't remember, Secret Agent, which had its own kind of weird racial connotations.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So. Oh, actually, it's a triple bill because Secret Agent did, Sabotage sort of did, and Young and Innocent definitely does.
Well, see, that's just the interesting thing, is because the clip that they show is just Cock Robin getting shot by the arrow and dying. Like, that's all they show. So I think that the only reason Hitchcock chose this is to continue on with the bird motif in the film and to signify the with her trying to laugh at what she's seeing and then realizing that she's laughing at death and knowing that her brother has just died.
Yeah.
You know, like that kind and of.
They have to have something on the screen as she walks through the theater.
Yeah.
They literally just need a piece of film playing and for the to explain why the audience is in the room and all that.
Yeah.
But you're right. Like, she's trying to cheer herself up while she's mourning her brother's tragic death. Yeah.
It does continue that bird motif, which I didn't realize, because I'll be honest, I was looking it up and I was like, has there been, and it does appear in a few more films, but we'll mention them as we come to them.
Chris, where can people find you when you're not sticking your nose up at brown cabbage?
Stop following me. How do you know I do this? No, you can find me on Twitter.
Seriously.
You can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy, where I will just kind of talk about anything and chat to people and get involved in doing whatever. Feel free to say hi. Along with Good Evening, I also co-host a podcast called North by Nerd West with me and my best mate Emma Platt. We meet up every so often and have a chat about kind of nerd culture and kind of what's going on in pop culture and discuss wider issues. It's a lot of fun. Our first 12 episodes are, you know, available on SoundCloud and on iTunes. We're hoping to get some more done this year. We've both been really busy though, but we are hoping to get some out this year. I also appear regularly on a couple of other podcasts, one of which is Smorgasbord, hosted by Pete Gaskell, which is a game show, and also on Eccentric Earth, which is a very cool unknown history podcast with my friend Amy Walker, who every episode it's a guest. She doesn't tell them what they're going to be covering, and she kind of starts to give you an interesting piece of information about history or a cool historical tale. So I've covered everything from kind of like Mothman to massacres to paleontology to all that kind of stuff. So I always walk away either slightly terrified or very well informed, or both.
Or both. Tom, where can people find you when you're not being violated with a toothbrush?
Or having hair gel put in my hair against my free will. Tom Caldwell 3000 on Twitter. The Tom Caldwell on Instagram. I do talk a lot about my dog on Instagram. And there's a wonderful photo of him wearing a dress shirt of mine, which was the highlight of our days that day. But yeah, no, thank you for... I do always like to say thank you to everybody that follows us on Facebook and on Twitter. And comments Absolutely. And suggestions and ideas and feedback are always appreciated and always welcomed.
Mm-hmm, you bet. And as for me, when I'm not, when I'm not trying to, blow people up, you can find me on Twitter on at Brandon McCullough.
You really wish you'd say violated for too much for yourself, didn't you?
I didn't. Definitely did not want to save that one for me. No way. No way. No how. You can find me on the United Federation of Podcast Network at UFP Earth on Twitter with my friend Zach Moore, and we have a podcast called Franchise Fatigue. And as of this recording here, we've recorded all of our episodes on Mission Impossible, and we'll be soon covering the Pet Sematary films, which is going to be a lot of fun. I believe episode 5 and 6 of Mission Impossible have been released. I don't know. It's tough trying to plan that far in the future here. But that's a lot of fun. We go through all the films in a movie franchise, and we look at them as they progress, and we talk about them. And you can find me on Trek FM every once in a while with Warp 5 and Melodic Treks. One is about Star Trek Enterprise, and one is about the music of Star Trek. And that's pretty much it. Every once in a while, I'm also on Cinematic Sound Radio. Oh, and as of the release of this, it should be out. I did a two-part interview with Jason Cullimore, who is the composer of our theme song. And we talk about digital music construction, digital music creation. And we also talk about his career in the second part of that interview. So it's a two-part release. He was at my place over Christmas, and we did an interview in my basement.
So I love our theme song so much.
It is so cool.
My favorite. I love to get it up on the loud, on the big speakers in my house and just crank it. Genuinely, and everybody that I've played it for thinks it's amazing.
Genuinely, my dad has been insisting to listen to the show, and I was like, oh yeah, I'll find it. I just never got around to doing it. And my brother played it off iTunes for him, and he did say the theme song. He just went, oh, this is really good. Who did this? And I went, it's our friend Jason.
Our friend Jason,
it was really good. He thought it was like, oh yeah, no, where did you steal this from? I'm like, no, this is specially created for us. How dare you?
Yes.
Good job, Jason. No, we were, my coworkers last night at work, I was talking to them about the show, and we played the theme in our office on the big speakers, and it just sounds so good. I really enjoy that. It's legit. Yeah.
Legit, we feel special. Yeah. Well, thanks so much to Jason for creating our wonderful theme song. You can find him on the internet at jasoncullimore.com. That is his website. He's on SoundCloud. You can find his music on iTunes, so please support him. I would like to thank very much. We have a new credit that we'd like to give out to our good friend Pat McFadden. We are going to give him, going forward, the associate producer credit for all the behind-the-scenes research that he's been doing and helping us out with. So thank you so much, Pat McFadden. We truly appreciate it. And we have decided to give you the title of Tom. What? How do make sure we word this properly here?
Pat McFadden, our man who knows exactly enough.
Our man who knows exactly
Thank you, Pat.
Enough. I love
Pat. Like you said, Pat has been essential to the success of our show, helping us research the programming that we were looking at and giving us ideas. And he's always got great feedback and great suggestions and very intelligent comments on our films. We have had him on the show before, mm-hmm. and I'm sure we'll be having him on a few more times as we go through our series of films.
Yeah. So basically, Pat is the man who stops us from going psycho.
Yes.
I saw the opportunity and I went for it.
Yes. And, you know, and since we're in Canada and you're in Britain and he's in the States, he is also our foreign correspondent.
Our foreign correspondent who stops us from going psycho.
And he knows exactly enough.
Or from going in a frenzy.
Thank you. Thank you so much to the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show in their feed. We also have it available on our own independent feed, but we couldn't be here without the wonderful gentlemen over at FanPod Network mm-hmm. on Twitter. And they've got a lot of great shows. Be sure to check it out. And don't forget to take a listen to Annie and Catherine and their wonderful show, Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents Podcast, where they go through all of Hitchcock's episodes of his show, Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And it's a heck of a lot of fun. And with their show and our show combined, you get a near comprehensive look at the Grand Master's work. Until next time, when we cover Young and Innocent, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Oh, listen, all y'all, is a sabotage!
Alrighty.
Forgot about it.